Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Hoth Takes. I'm Grace Seegers.
I'm Haley Bird-Wilt.
And I'm Eric Geller.
And we are so thrilled for this episode. We have an extremely special guest star, a writer that we are all big fans of, plus another huge Star Wars nerd with the articles to prove it, and that is The Atlantic's Adam Serwer. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today we are going to be talking about insurgency in Star Wars with a particular focus on Andor, because as anyone who has watched Andor and or and dash or, that was a better pun in my mind than it was in actuality, and dash or listened to our Andor episodes, knows that there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening in Andor in terms of actually showing rebellion, actually showing the stakes of what's going on, what it takes, and highly recommend that you check out Adam's article in The Atlantic about Andor. He wrote about this very topic. It's called Star Wars Gets Political. And yeah, it's a very good article, much like everything Adam writes. But to get started, I just wanted to open the conversation by asking, what do we think of how Andor depicts insurgency and rebellion as compared to other Star Wars media? And really, what makes Andor special? So, Adam, I would love to get your thoughts on that first.
Well, I think, you know, you have to look at Andor as kind of an extension of the rebellion as portrayed in Rogue One, which is, you know, it's more split up than in Rogue One, because of course it's a prequel to Rogue One. And I think, you know, perhaps the main distinction is that the rebellion in Andor is a lot less religious than the one we see in Rogue One. I mean, if you remember watching Rogue One, you know, at the end, you know, it begins with the destruction of, you know, what they call a holy city. The characters pray, you know, there's a line in it about, you know, Andor's relationship with the Force. You know, the people sort of lay people, you know, we hear a lot about the Force in Jedi, but in Rogue One, we see the way lay people relate to the Force, and they sort of see it the way you would see a monotheistic God, sort of in terms of the way they relate to it and the way they pray to it. And I think, you know, in Rogue One, the major division is between Saw Gerrera's faction, which is characterized as extreme by Mon Mothma. And I think, you know, even in Andor, there's sort of a hint that, you know, Saw is more brutal than some of his compatriots, something that I think Luthen appreciates and likes, and is probably one of the reasons why he prevents Saw from intervening, knowing that the Empire is going to do what it's going to do. But I just think, you know, it is much messier. I mean, if you look at the beginning of Rogue One, for example, you know, it's very much something that I think is attempting to evoke the war in Afghanistan, maybe even the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. These are insurgents, as we have, you know, the portrayal of insurgents is very much shaped by the war on terror, by previous films such as the Battle of Algiers. And I think, you know, I think that sort of messiness is very different from, even though Lucas, you know, famously said that the rebels in Star Wars were in part inspired by the Viet Cong. I think we see a much more vivid extension or rendition of that idea in Andor than we have in previous Star Wars media, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I have so many directions that I want to go based on that. But I think you bringing up faith and the Force is really interesting, because Andor is obviously very different from other Star Wars in that we don't see any Jedi or Sith or Force, and actually really love how Rogue One depicts the Force and its interaction in sort of everyday life. So what do we think about having an idea of rebellion that isn't grounded in this spirituality that we've come to know from previous Star Wars, but have it feel sort of, I don't want to say more real, because faith is an important part of lots of rebellions, but just having that difference, how do we feel about that?
Well, it's more personal. It's more personal and ideological, right? Because you know, the show wants to know what makes someone a rebel, what makes someone an imperial, and it goes through sort of, you know, we have Nemec's Manifesto, which is sort of, you know, an important ideological document. But like Jyn Erso, you know, Andor is not initially interested in political anything. So you know, there's sort of an exploration of what happens in someone's life to make them want to rebel, that is not, you know, I think faith is an undercurrent to the show. I mean, if you look at the way Marva talks about the Empire in her final speech, when she says, you know, there's a darkness at the heart of the universe, or even the way Luthen talks about his mind being a sunless place, there's a rhetoric of darkness and light that the characters are constantly playing with that sounds almost like they're talking about the Force, but could just be, you know, metaphorical language. But I think that, you know, that's, you know, one of the more interesting parts of the show is grounding it, as you said, in these sort of, and not necessarily real world events, because obviously it's a space opera, but sort of things that are recognizable as personal motivations in the real world.
Yeah, Adam used the word messy, and I think it's a great way to summarize how this is different from Rogue One and from the rest of the Star Wars movies, because you really see how these people are motivated, particularly, you know, the people who join up with the rebellion are motivated by very concrete acts of brutality or oppression or marginalization. There's a couple great moments, like when the TIE fighter kind of buzzes over the group on Aldani, and you can just tell that this is something that they do all the time just to show off their power. And Nemec says, you know, they don't expect something like that to come from below. It's this idea that all across the galaxy, people are being slighted and hurt and brutalized in these very specific, concrete ways. It's not about high-minded rhetoric. It's not about there's a Sith in charge of the galaxy and the Jedi must rise up and defeat the darkness. It's not even really about, like, you know, Adam mentioned, you know, Jedha and sort of the holy moon there. It's not about these abstract ideas of, you know, should darkness or light have a monopoly on power or be able to control events. It's very much like, you know, you killed my family or you destroyed my town or whatever the case may be. It's a much darker version of this conflict, which was never bright and sunny to begin with. I mean, they blew up a planet in the first movie, but it's much more ground level and it's much more sort of relatable to understand why you would want to fight against something that has treated you like dirt. And we see some great examples of how they treat people like dirt.
So I would counter, I don't know if it's like more ground level so much as it is earlier. And obviously it depends on each individual character and their own like ideas of faith, but it does seem like, you know, maybe the stakes of rebellion could drive people closer to, you know, those kinds of legends or those stories or those ideas. And so I am curious if in the second season, I hadn't thought of that before, Adam, when you mentioned it, that Rogue One was a lot more religious in tone and nature. So I'm curious to see if it grows that way, or even if they want to explore the idea of like using religion as a rallying cry or, you know, a way to get people to join their cause. I don't know. I think that would be interesting to explore.
I expect that's going to be a part of it. I mean, the Empire is violently, violently secular, even in both versions. I mean, you know, we see how they talk about the traditions on Aldani. You know, they're just, they consider, you know, and this makes sense as sort of a narrative aspect of the Empire, because, you know, in the first movie we hear, you know, we have that admiral who gets choked, who's like, you know, that ancient religion, your sorcerer's ways, there's like a contempt for the Force that I think is sort of ideologically consistent with Palpatine's empire, because they're like, we don't want anybody like rediscovering the Force or something. We don't want there to be like a religious revival. And so it makes sense that the Empire has a sort of violent contempt for any religious manifestation, including, you know, I mean, when you think, I mean, like the final scene, which is sort of like this Shakespearean thing where all the characters are on the same stage at the same time, is like, you know, it's a funeral. They're disrupting a funeral. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, I think this is sort of the faith aspect is not there the way it is in Rogue One. Like Andor talks about having a relationship with the Force in Rogue One, which is just like actually kind of jarring after watching Andor, because that side of things is not present. But I mean, like you, I do wonder if that's something that's going to come up next season, also because of the sort of hints that we've been given about Luthen's background.
Yeah, I think that point about faith is a really interesting one. And there's definitely a through line about the importance of community throughout Andor, the first season of Andor, even in what we see on Aldani. And I think that also shows how assimilation is a really key tool that the Empire is using, where they don't just want to control a planet or its resources. They recognize that to control its people, they need to truly stamp out its culture. And we see that on Aldani and on Ferrix. So I do think that there is sort of an undercurrent there that could be returned to, particularly if in the second season, as we're continuing to see the development of Andor as a rebel, perhaps his connection to the Force comes with having more of a training in the rebellion. And you mentioned Luthen, Adam. Now I'm curious, do you believe in the fan theory that he is a Jedi? This is slightly off topic, but you raised the point.
So I don't know if Luthen is. This is what I've said elsewhere. I don't know if Luthen is a Jedi. I know that the show wants you to think he's a Jedi. He talks about his sort of tutelage in the dark arts of rebellion as a kind of sacrifice of, you know, his soul, in a way that sounds like he, like that monologue he gives in the elevator shaft is, you know, I've turned to the dark side to beat the Empire. Like that's what that monologue is meant to be. Or like the scene where Two Tubes, who actually makes it to Rogue One, he's in Rogue One, when he sort of asks for his walking stick and the camera lingers on it and he's like, what's this? I mean, that is a shot that is meant to exploit the audience's recognition of an object that looks like a lightsaber hilt. So I think the show wants us to believe he is a Jedi. I don't know that he necessarily is. Maybe it's a huge head fake. It would be a pretty big, like, Chekhov's lightsaber, so to speak, for like, with all these hints, to not have, to have him, like, end up being, like, you know, actually, he's just an art dealer. And this, like, weirdly intimate relationship he has with this young woman in his, you know, obviously it's a platonic relationship, but this relationship that he has with this young woman in his art dealership, that's not a master and a Padawan who have given up their, you know, their formal relationship in a religion that no longer exists. Maybe, like, again, maybe he's not a Jedi. I'm not saying he's a Jedi. I am saying that I think the show has explicitly led us in that direction. And I guess we'll find out next season.
I do want to talk about Luthen just in general as compared to the other sort of quote-unquote leaders that we see in the rebellion. And you said earlier that you think Luthen like Saw for his ruthlessness and his sort of realpolitik understanding of how things need to work. And you reference that incredible speech by Luthen about sacrificing everything good in yourself and using the tools of your enemy to defeat your enemy. And I think it raises a lot of interesting questions about morality of a rebellion, because a lot of times in media we see a character being like, oh, I can't use the tools of my enemy because then I'll be just as bad as they are. And that's often the case in revenge narratives, that the lesson to be learned is that you don't want to stoop to the same level of your enemy. But in this show, there are characters who are using those tools, and the argument is that, well, sometimes they are necessary. So I think it feeds into this sort of idea of messiness, but do we think that there is an underarching moral argument to Andor, the show, or is it just, you know, well, things are complicated, fam?
I mean, you know, when we first meet Andor in Rogue One, he shoots a guy to escape, right? He gets the information about the pilot, and you know they get interrupted by stormtroopers, so he just, you know, he kills them. So, you know, and he talks about all the things he's done that are bad to get to this moment. So I do think like the theme of the show is sort of like, how much of your soul are you willing to sell for a cause? At the same time, I think, you know, what's interesting to me about, you know, about that speech is it very much feels like a Jedi speech to me. Like Andor is not sitting there thinking, what have I done? Right. You know, he's killed a lot of people, but he's not been out of shape by murdering those two corpos in the first episode, right? He's not tortured by it. I think like this is a like Luthen's approach is like a specific, very Jedi approach where the means is as important as the result. And I think that, you know, that it would be a hell of a coincidence if he turns out not to be a Jedi precisely because that is such a Jedi speech to give. But I do think the show tries to like draw moral lines. I mean, there's that scene on Aldani where Vel says something about that the Imperial governor says something like, the, you know, if I talk, you're just going to kill my kids anyway. And Vel says, why? Because that's what you would do. And they don't end up killing the kids. I mean, I do think that they are trying to draw a line between the Empire's ruthlessness and, you know, some things that may be necessary in pursuit of the rebellion. But each character, and this is one of the great things about the show, they have their lines are in different places. Like Andor's line is not where Luthen's line is, and Luthen's line is not where Saw's line is, and Mon Mothma's line is not where any of those characters' line is. Like she is, you know, horrified by the sort of violent realities of rebellion, even though she should know that that's what it is. You know, and again, this is one of the interesting things about the show is that people's ideological and class backgrounds inform their sense of right and wrong in a way that feels organic to the characters. So I think there are things that if they were done, it would change our view of the characters, but I do think it's important to note that within the show, it's simply that the characters draw those lines in different places.
I did find it interesting just the way that it depicts it differently. And like Rebels got into that sort of debate between like Saw Gerrera and other factions of the rebellion, but it was always sort of like, I don't know, boiled down to the willingness to kill. And I found myself, I mean, when you watch Rebels or you watch other, like, you know, storylines in Rebels where they're, you know, rebelling, they're like trying to save like a group of Wookiee slaves that are like they discover on a ship. Like it's like mm-hmm. actively trying to do good things. And I don't know if it's like stated explicitly or if it's implied in Andor. I think it's stated explicitly that the raid on Aldani was intended to increase the Empire's oppression, like mm-hmm. of everyone. And so, like, the amount of suffering caused by that, I don't know. I found myself kind of taken aback. And that's why I said in our last episode that, like, the episodes that stood out to me the most and that I will remember Andor for were the prison camp, like, episodes, because I just found those incredibly powerful. And, like, I don't know. I don't know if Andor or Luthen like spend enough time reckoning with. I mean, you hear from people in the prison who'd like tell them like, is anyone talking about this? And they're, I don't know. I was taken aback by that. I was like, this is different. This kind of strategy that just like increases everyone's suffering with the hope of some future rebellion that people will join with the hope that it will be successful. I don't know. I found it impactful, but also very different than what we've seen in other parts of Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, no, I agree. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it makes explicit something that's been an undercurrent of Star Wars from the beginning, which is, you know, when the rebels are doing these raids on garrisons or whatever, for the most part, Star Wars, you know, makes it clear that they're trying, that pretty much all the rebels we meet up until Andor are really trying to just limit what they're doing to military targets, right? They get painted as the good guys specifically because they often say explicitly, like, we are going to try to avoid hurting innocent people. But the implication of all of this is what happens when the Empire hits back? They're not just going to target like rebel bases marked with the rebel logo on it. Like, this is always going to come back on civilians. There's always going to be some kind of either collateral damage or reprisal. Everything the rebels have been doing from day one has been putting civilians in the crosshairs, even if they are not trying to do so. And so to actually see it being more explicit with Luthen saying, that's the plan. This is my goal, is to put more people in harm's way to increase the number of people who get radicalized into taking action. I mean, it is very much this real world concept of accelerationism, where the goal is to drive more people to the breaking point because you know that's when they're going to take radical action. And this is the first time that we've actually seen somebody say, that's what I want to happen, as opposed to just, if you game it out, all the other Star Wars that we've seen, well, you know that there are going to be reprisals and civilians are going to be hit and some of them are going to be radicalized. And here we actually see it made explicit.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, this is the flip side of that line that Leia has, you know, the tighter your grip, the more systems will slip through your fingers. And the distinction, of course, is that Luthen is seeking out, he's trying to make the grip tighter. Like, you know, the obviously the Rey has a financial incentive, but he says, you know, as y'all have already noted, he says explicitly, I want the Empire to respond in an extreme way, because then it just illustrates, you know, how oppressive they are, and more people are going to want to rebel. And that's an observation that is, you know, borne out in the final episode, where, you know, if they don't interrupt the funeral, does Marva's, you know, they're the ones who validate Marva's speech. Their inability to allow her to make this call to arms without interrupting, without kicking the droid, without you know, trying to silence her speech, ironically, is the spark that causes people to rebel. So it sort of illustrates it precisely what Luthen is talking about. And even though he's not like the architect of that incident, it bears out his strategy.
And, you know, we haven't talked about the Imperial side of things too much, but this actually puts Dedra Miro in an interesting light, because in one of the middle episodes, she recognizes Luthen's gambit, and she says, we're playing into their hands, right? All these, you know, the PORD and all this stuff, this is what they want. But then later, she is the one to arrange the situation on Ferrix that turns it into the powder keg that it is. And as Adam, as you said, they validate what Marva is saying and what Luthen is pushing for. And she's kind of behind all of that. I mean, she could have done more to keep everybody in restraint. She didn't kick the droid over, but she certainly arranged the chess pieces so that was inevitable. So on the one hand, she seems to understand what Luthen is going for. And she says other people who can't see the big picture are playing into his hands. On the other hand, she also ends up playing into his hands.
So I actually think this is kind of an example of sort of the classism that Adam mentioned earlier, how we don't know much about Dedra's background, but we get the impression that she is a scrappy up-and-comer who everyone else thinks doesn't belong there. So she is from, just to put it sort of basically, like a lower class than the other Imperials. And so then she is able to recognize what's going to happen with the little people, because she was once the little people. But then once she joins the upper class, if you will, in this analogy of the Imperials, then I think she loses some of that perspective. But I think that there is that kind of undercurrent of classism as well in Andor's Cassian speech about how the Imperials are so fat and happy and they can't imagine that anyone like me would be able to walk through their gates. And you have the wealthy governor on Aldani looking down on the people of Aldani. And I think that's all part and parcel with denigrating the cultures of a region. It's not the clear class boundaries that we have in our world and universe, but there are definitely those boundaries of class that you see in every element of this show, including with Mon Mothma and her understanding of rebellion. And I think that's sort of an interesting undercurrent to all of this, because in a sense, this is really an uprising of the little people against the big monolithic empire, and who is facilitating that rebellion may include some of the upper classes, but ultimately I think it may be conducted or stir from the people themselves.
Yeah, it is a beautiful connection to the dynamics that we see in all kinds of real world rebellions and revolutions. And here I have to give a shout out to Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast, which is winding down in the next few weeks, because it is a great walkthrough of all these different historical revolutions. And he makes sure to go into detail about how, while there are people in the inner circle of the ruling class who become disaffected and are providing the financing and the sort of ideological grounding for the eventual revolution, it is the populist anger, it is the streets, it is the people who have been living with the oppression at that very base level who power this to success. And ultimately what happens next is you have to balance the competing interest of the people who are in the ruling class, just want to make some minor changes to the system, with the people who are outside the ruling class, have had the worst of the suffering, and they want to blow the whole thing up. And they're the ones, again, in the streets, generating the anger, holding the guns. And so the people on the inside have to sort of calibrate, how much do you give them, right? How much do you appease them? And we haven't actually seen that in Star Wars, mostly because we don't actually see much of the post-revolution world, right? The New Republic era would be the analogy there, and we haven't actually seen an exploration of what Mon Mothma does in that situation. But what we're seeing here is the earlier stages of it, where you have people like Mon Mothma who probably don't want to do everything that Luthen wants to do. Luthen is much more sort of in touch with those people at the ground level, and eventually they're going to have to sort of triangulate and sort of triage how much they do to appease each of these different interests.
I think one of the things that's useful to think about, I mean, we see, we see Admiral Yularen in this series. He has a short cameo, or maybe two cameos. I'm not sure, but he's a character we recognize from the Clone Wars series. And I think, you know, the removal of the Jedi means the removal of an entire elite strata of the governing class that is then, you know, filled in part by the old Republic elite, some of whom we see and recognize. But I think, and one of the things that this show does well is that, you know, you mentioned, you know, Cyril and Dedra are not, you know, they're not the old Republic elite like Yularen is, right? They are strivers. They are people for whom the destruction of the Jedi and the rise of the Empire has brought new opportunities. Right. So it's not that they are sort of, you know, we know how Andor sees the Imperials. They're all, you know, fat and happy and privileged. But we see these Imperial characters who are not from wealthy class backgrounds, and they have perceived their own interests as, you know, the opportunity to rise within the Empire itself. And that's one of the great things about the show, is that it's not a simple, like, you know, people's class background informs their decisions. But it's more complicated than just, you know, this person comes from this kind of background and therefore they're this type of person. It's a much more interesting and sophisticated exploration of people's individual motivations. And you could actually see, I mean, like you look at Mon Mothma's position in a similar way, and also Luthen's position. I mean, if Luthen is a Jedi, then he is part of that elite strata that has been wiped away. He lost everything that made him a significant person, if he is a Jedi. And Mon Mothma is a senator. She's part of an institution that is increasingly, as we know, obsolete as part of the governing class. It makes sense that someone like that would want to rebel, but maybe not necessarily blow the whole system up because she's still a part of it. Whereas someone like Luthen, who has maybe lost everything, and I think that's the implication, you know, he is going to be much more radicalized, even though he seems to at least have come from enough of an elite background to be an art dealer in the wealthy section of Coruscant.
Yeah, I think this show is just so good at showing us all of those complex considerations and sort of thinking about what Haley was talking about, how we really see the effect on people. We see what's happening in the prison, which is pretty horrific, and we see even when there is the insurrection on Ferrix and this community rising up as one, they get slaughtered. There's still a bunch of people with sticks and rocks going up against a military force that is trained, and they are sloppy and chaotic. And having that violence sort of be an end unto itself, including as well as the mean, is, as we've said, something we really haven't seen before in Star Wars. But that raises the larger question that I'd like to delve into a bit more, where clearly the Empire is bad, and it's a literal evil empire. And so is this show kind of demonstrating that when you're up against something that great, that there is no end or no means or very few means that aren't justified? We're talking about everyone having different lines. But I think in doing so, it's interesting to look at our own lines because media is very much a reflection of who we are and our own world. And this is getting very philosophical, but what do we think about that idea that there may not be too great of a cost to pay when you are fighting against something that is just so completely evil at its core?
So it's probably naive of me, but I think there always is a cost that, like say the war on terror, like it's not exactly like comparable, but torture was not, like, that was not something that we should have done. And, like, I'm very much with the late John McCain on that kind of question. And they sort of show you that in Andor. Like, that scene where they're torturing Bix is horrific. And I thought that it was very, effective. And so I think it would be difficult to see someone like Luthen, like, pulling out those kinds of strategies or, like, doing that to an Imperial. And I know he gave that big monologue about making his mind a sunless place, but I don't know, like, maybe it's naive of me, but I, like, definitely would see that differently than, I don't know, like, combat or like, killing. So I don't know. I'm curious what Adam thinks on that.
I mean, I think truthfully the show never puts, I mean, it puts the characters in some morally compromising situations, but I don't think it ever, like, we're talking about an empire that, you know, we've seen destroy an entire planet of people that has no weapons. Like, we've never been in a situation, like, it, you know, the most fraught moral situations that the characters are put in terms of right and wrong are when Luthen has to keep his spy from, you know, from who wants to like cease being an informant, when he has to tell him like, no, actually, you know, does it, you're in for life. And the moment when he sacrifices a rebel faction to the Empire, knowing that he can save them because it would mean being discovered. I'm not sure that there's another situation in there that's really, you know, we never really see them put in a situation where, well, I don't know. I mean, we get people handling situations in ways that maybe I wouldn't. You know, obviously Andor, when I'm blanking on his name, but the guy who participates in the heist and turns out to have made up his whole radicalization story is just completely fake. Skeen. And the Skeen is sort of, you know, we know that Skeen has like experienced depression. He's got the Imperial prison tattoo, which is, you know, foreshadowing for Andor. You know, but he, you know, Andor just murders him on the spot, which like isn't a good guy thing to do. But it's never like the rebels are never put in a position where they're like, we are deliberately causing suffering just to cause suffering. The characters are not those type of characters. So in a way, like, even though, you know, Andor is a very morally sophisticated show, it's certainly not the case that we ever forget who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. We just have a greater humanization of both sides of the conflict, because we follow those POV characters around. But I don't think, you know, there's never a point in which I'm like, if I'm watching the show as a viewer, there's never a moment in which I think to myself, this character has definitely gone too far and, you know, I don't like them anymore. I think it's not quite that type of show yet. It may become that type of show at some point. But I don't think there's a moment there where
that's
where
how you know I'm a whip. Really... I definitely had those moments with Luthen. Like I do not. And maybe for me, it was that monologue in the elevator where the guy is trying to get out and he has his like a daughter and he wants to just like be safe. And Luthen doesn't let him do that. And, like, yes, there's strategy behind that, and there's a reason for it, but, like,
but he's not just doing it to be cruel, you know what I mean? Like, like there is, you know, the Imperials are constantly doing things. They're engaging in acts of cruelty just to be cruel.
Right.
Luthen is like, you have to stay in here. And mm-hmm. then he gives this whole monologue where he's like, look, I understand that you're scared and you're tortured and you have these dark nights of the soul, but that is the thing that we have committed to, and I'm there too. My life is just as fucked up as yours. It's not like, you know, it's not like the Imperial who's like begging the agent. He's like, can I have the title of Viceroy? You know, he's like, you know what I'm saying? It's not an exercise of power just, you know, just for the purpose of exercising power. They like for all like there are some people who complain about this, like muddying the reputation of the rebels too much or making it too unclear that the rebels are the good guys. I don't think the show ever does that. I think it's very clear who the good guys and the bad guys are the entire time in a way that's very Star Wars. It just manages to make the characters interesting enough that we're not thinking about that. We're thinking about each character's personal moral conflicts and journey.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the key sort of distinction is like, they are both, you know, the rebels and the Empire are both open to the idea of, you know, visiting cruelty upon sort of non-combatants. The question is, to what end? For the Empire, it's about maintaining control. For the rebels, it's about breaking that control. I mean, Luthen doesn't want people to suffer because he sees them as, you know, inferior aliens or because he wants them to be kept in their place. It's the exact opposite. He knows that the more suffering there is, the more people will stand up and throw off the shackles. So it's just about, what do you want to do with the shackles? Are you trying to cause cruelty so that more people will submit to the shackles, or cause cruelty so that more people will throw them off? And as Adam said, they never leave that ambiguous. It's always clear that if there's any embrace of cruelty on the rebel side, it is to the end of getting people to be frustrated and to rise up. They never muddy the waters too much there. But what they do is they take it to that next step of, well, obviously, if you're fighting the bad guys, if you're fighting the government, you're going to need to win people over to your side. How do you get people to join you? They have to experience what you experienced in some form or fashion. And that is not something that was ever explicit in Star Wars before. Again, if you think about it at any point in the history of this franchise, obviously, some degree of that was always happening. That's how they're recruiting people. People are suffering and joining up. This is the first time that they actually say explicitly, this is a goal of the good guys, and they're still the good guys, but we want you to think about what it takes to be the good guys in this fight, and what it takes is bringing more people in, and that doesn't happen because of high-minded ideals, at least not for most people. For most people, it's not finding out that, you know, you can wield a lightsaber and you've got to join the good guys. They killed your family and you want to fight back at them, and making that explicit is Andor's sort of signature triumph, I would argue.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about the show is the imagery used to depict the good guys. I mean, you know, Grace has brought this up previously about Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, Battlestar Galactica, not to cross the nerd streams too much, but Battlestar Galactica is a show that airs in the middle of the war on terror, that depicts human terrorists as the good guys, because they are fighting to liberate themselves from, you know, the Cylons, who are not exactly evil. Because that would, you know, it, at least not, that's not all they are. That's not the extent of what they are. And when you look at those images from say like the Battle of New Caprica, from the occupation of New Caprica, that is like, those are really sort of risky. It was a risky thing to depict the good guys as terrorists, essentially, or as using terrorism as a method of rebellion. And it's very hard to imagine the scene, you know, in the final episode where, you know, a boy on Ferrix is tossing essentially what is a pipe bomb into a group of stormtroopers in the middle of the riot. I mean, that's an image that I don't think you would air that, in like 2005. Like, I'm not sure you could even do that. And I think to some extent some left-wing folks have embraced the show, it is in part because it's clearly, very clearly drawing on images of revolutionary violence from what they see as sympathetic causes. And I don't think that's an accident. I think the show is very consciously drawing from particular moments in history and using them in a way in which they're sort of, they work thematically with the show and they're somewhat recognizable, but they're also not like, oh, this is exactly an imitation of this. I mean, the prison escape, like, to me is like, you know, very much evokes an episode in which there's an uprising in a concentration camp during the Holocaust that happens after, you know, the arrival of like a group of Red Army soldiers and the insurgency is sort of already being planned. And like, there's just very much, it is very evocative of that incident, but it's also evocative of other incidents. They do a very good job of remixing these historical moments in way that we sort of emotionally recognize them, but they don't feel like sort of cut and paste jobs of like, oh, they're doing, you know, the storming of the Bastille and that's exactly what this is. It's done much better or much more subtly than that.
I do want to talk about that pipe bombing or you know, the equivalent in Star Wars. If I'm remembering correctly, I feel like they didn't show anything very like gruesome or like stark from that. Like, I feel like it blew up like a tank or something. And I don't know if they shied away from that, but like the rest of that scene, they really didn't shy away from death. Like, there was a very lingering shot of a dead resident of Ferrix. And so I don't know. I think it's interesting in hindsight. I remember watching him like building the bomb. I was like, oh no, like he's going to get people on both sides. And like, it seemed like he didn't. It seemed like he like took out some kind of weaponry and they didn't even really show like stormtroopers dying from it. So I don't know. I wonder if even in showing a tactic like that, they sort of shied away from like, what if it makes them look too bad? Or, and of course it's, you know, Star Wars and Disney and like, it's not expecting, you know, full violence, full like gore, but
yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of blood on this show. There's a decent amount of death, but there's not a lot of blood.
Yeah,
But I do think it's interesting that one of the victims of that attack is the guy who sort of betrayed Ferrix and turned in Cassian. And he goes and sort of rats him out, and then they stash him in their headquarters, and he's one of the people who's killed. I thought it was interesting because it almost reminded me of the way that, you know, in the sort of the code era of Hollywood, you know, you could never show bad guys getting away with it. They always had to get their comeuppance, and that evolved eventually into a more sort of commonplace, you know, after the code was eliminated, you would still have a lot of people who had done some small bad thing get some kind of comeuppance just to show people that, you know, you don't want to do this, right? If you do this, there will be some sort of karmic justice. Now, obviously, that's not how it works in the real world, at least not most of the time. People get away with bad things a lot of the time. And I was kind of surprised that a show like Andor, as messy and gritty and realistic as it was, would go out of its way to sort of embrace that idea of, you know, he's not like some big time Imperial bad guy, but he did something bad that led to bad things happening. And they took time out of the episode to show him sort of suffering for it. You know, he ultimately was done in by this conflict that he helped to set up or to orchestrate.
He's also the second snitch to get got because Tim gets shot by the corpos.
That's right. Yeah.
When he's trying to save Bix. This has happened. This is not the first time that someone who's intending to betray the rebellion ends up getting done in by their own attempt to profit. I mean, it also happens with Skeen. Pretty much everybody who tries to betray the rebellion in some way, big or small, ends up getting got. And I think actually it's very smart to identify that as one of the like very clear moral currents of the show. You're absolutely right, Eric. It's very clear that the one thing you cannot do and survive on Andor is snitch.
I think too, it shows, and maybe I'm giving a little bit of the benefit of the doubt here, but it shows that being a snitch and self-preservation will not save you. Like the idea that even if you decide to work within the system instead of against it, that what you think is going to protect you will not end up doing so. And the system, the churn, will turn on you just like it turns on everyone else. So to add a little bit more nuance to it, but I do think you're right. I actually hadn't noticed that pattern, but that certainly is an interesting theme that snitches get stitches here on Andor. So I know we've been talking for a little while, but before we end our conversation, I just want to briefly segue into talking about other Star Wars media showing insurgency and what that looks like. I know that Adam is a big fan of the show Rebels and is actually the one who convinced me to watch Rebels, for which I am eternally grateful because it's a great show. So what do we think about Andor's depiction of rebellion compared to other Star Wars, so Rebels, the original trilogy, what are some key differences there?
Well, so obviously Rebels is geared towards a young audience, and it has some, you know, it has some very serious moments. It has some moments where important characters die, so it's not completely shying away from violence. It has, I think, in a way similar to Andor, it has very almost local focus on the protagonist's home planet and his commitment to liberating his home planet from the Empire. But I think, you know, one of the things that, I mean, personally, my takeaway from Andor is like I see a lot of people saying like, why can't every Star Wars be like this? But I actually don't feel like every Star Wars has to be like this. I love that Andor is like this, but I love that Rebels is what it is. You know, every Star Wars does not have to be grown-up Star Wars. It's okay to have different types of Star Wars for different types of audiences. And I think, you know, thematically, Rebels is a show that I enjoy because, in part because it very much captured the feel of the original trilogy when I was a kid, that sort of sense of menace, particularly around Darth Vader. And it's a fun show. But it's not, you know, it's not an exploration of the political economy of the Empire the way that Andor is. And that's okay. Like, I want to be explicit. Like, I think one of the things that, you know, Tony Gilroy has obviously had like a massive impact on the Star Wars universe through Andor and Rogue One. But I think the sort of Dave Filoni, the Filoni versus impact has been sort of similarly thematically good for the for the property in terms of like through Clone Wars trying to show us what Anakin was like as a rebel. I mean, sorry, what Anakin was like as a young Jedi, so that it's not, you know, our understanding of him is not simply from the very limited depiction in the prequels, or, you know, Rebels as a sort of glue with like what happens, you know, what happened to the Jedi during the Purge, or what happens to these planets that come under Imperial rule. I think that the great thing about Star Wars is it has room for many, many different types of stories and lends itself to many, many, many different types of genres. And, you know, Andor is just one of them. It's an exceptional one. But I wouldn't, you know, I don't want every Star Wars to be exactly like this.
Yeah, I think it's notable that the character who really made that jump from the animated to live action world was Saw Gerrera, who comes from the Onderon insurgency story arc. That's the place where, you know, we got to know him in animation. And it's a great example of how you don't have to be Andor, you don't have to be Tony Gilroy to tell a really interesting, nuanced story about insurgency and sacrifice. And, you know, even on that show, you had people disagreeing, you know, in that arc, you had people disagreeing about how do we take back our planet, right? What is too far? And in some ways, that story arc kind of presaged Andor or set the stage for Andor by creating that question of how do you go about this? And obviously within the universe, there's now this through line of he has gone through that experience, both, you know, with the Jedi, and then later on, once the Republic becomes the Empire, he sort of has to turn against the people he was working with, and then through that into the Andor Rogue One time period. So he's a great example, and Onderon is a great example of that whole dynamic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a great point just about how the Filoniverse sort of informs the Gilroy verse, you know, how you could sort of lay the groundwork with these more adult themes in these kids shows that can then be explored, you know, in a more grown up context. And I think it very much, they're very much complementary, even if, you know, they're aimed at basically different groups of people.
Okay. I'll throw a question your way, Adam. I have seen a fan theory that the little droid, whose name I'm blanking on, turns into the other droid in Rogue One, K2-9-something, K2-SO.
K2-SO.
Yes. And I'm curious what you think of that. Do you think that should be the case? Or
I do not think that's the case. Mm-hmm. I do not think it should be the case. Let that, you know, sweet little dog droid be a sweet little dog droid. I think, like, K2-SO is, you know, he is very much like a reformed psychopath. You know what I mean? Like his whole arc is like, I'm, you know, the moment, his like moment of grace in Rogue One is when Jen Erso hands him a blaster and he's like, wow, you're really my friend because this is all I've ever wanted. like he's reprogrammed, but he still wants to murder people.
Yeah, it's like if Chopper had been somewhat reprogrammed, but not fully. Like, Chopper is the pure distillation of that, and K2SO is, like, a little bit restrained.
But maybe he was just so inspired by Marva's, like, act of rebellion that he
See, I think Chopper is different, because Chopper is just like, droids are better than humans.
Yeah.
like
droid supremacist
Chopper. Chopper is just like, look, humans are stupid, they're soft, they don't have, like, infinite memories, they can't repair shit. I'm better than all these people. K2SO is like, I'm like built to murder things. And even though I'm like reprogrammed to be on a different side now, my like deep, like the deep thing in my soul that I need to do to fulfill myself is kill people. And I think that is like so different from B2 emo's like, please stay at my apartment with me now that my owner's gone because I don't want to be alone. Like, that's just a total different level of personality. I do not think that that fan theory is correct. I think the droids are too different in personality. I also think, you know, not every droid has to be another droid. Like, let there be two different droid characters.
Do you think that B2 Emo is going to be able to charge? I just realized that he left his charging pad.
No,
back
Eric,
at the house.
I can't stress out about something else. That's too sad to
oh
think
my
about.
God. Season 2 begins with B2 Emo's light going dark.
God, Eric.
Oh. Sorry, we were going to
really
try to
dark.
End on a light note here.
That is
that was,
really
that was my
dark.
Bad. I apologize.
Oh, man. That was a bummer.
See, you're just going to give us... I don't think they're going to start with like the Terminator 2 ending.
Yeah, it's been done.
All right, well, on that somewhat ridiculous note, Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Such a fun conversation, and
thank you so much for
we're
having
all
me.
Such fans. And to every listener, thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at hothtakes. I'm at Grace_Seegers on Twitter for however long it lasts. Eric is at Eric Geller. Haley is at Burdenator. And Adam, what is your Twitter handle?
It's just my name. You can find me there, I guess, you know, who knows how much longer, but...
Haley made our incredible logo and banner art, and Eric edited the show and put together our music, although for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com, and if you like the show, share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all of the major podcasting platforms, including Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.